This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. Last week on The Lines Between Us, we looked at how unemployment affects not just individuals, but communities. The week before, we looked at the path to employment, how to match the unemployed to the jobs that are available. This week, we're looking at the path to employment, but we're taking the term more literally. How do we get people to the jobs and job training that's available? Earlier this week, Melody Norris waited in the bitter cold for a bus at North Avenue in Charles Street. She works and studies at Test College of Technology in Towson, and she lives almost 2 miles from this bus stop at North and Pennsylvania Avenues. She spoke with producer Matt Purdy.
Okay, I got to catch the 13 to North and Charles, then I have to catch the 3, the Cromwell Bridge, all the way out Towson. And I only can catch that one bus. And it's not like it doesn't come on time sometimes, and sometimes it do, but then when it comes, it's crowded, and it's like you got to catch it. Like, you have to know the exact times it comes, or else you'll just be standing out just looking crazy. Yeah, you know, just depending on the bus, I don't know. And you see, as you can see now, I'm still standing here just waiting on the bus, and it's what, is it 8 o'clock yet? It's 7:58, so hopefully it comes in 2 minutes, which I doubt it.
Have you looked at trying to get a car?
Yes.
But it's...
it's not in my financial, with my financial income, it's not yet.
Okay.
But I'm saving, so
okay.
I should have one by this time next year.
Amber Jones is also saving for a car. She was a student at Towson University, but to save money, she left her campus housing and moved home to West Baltimore. Her average bus commute to Towson took her about an hour and a half.
It was pretty difficult. Especially when it came time to start scheduling classes. Like, for instance, I remember that I had an advisor who was trying to get me to take a 9 a.m. class, and I was insisting that it was too early, and she didn't really seem to understand until I explained to her that it could take me about 2 hours to get to campus from my house, which by car would only be about 20 minutes away.
Jones left Towson after her third year.
Part of what I was thinking about and my decision, along with just trying to make sure that I had enough money to fund my education without going into a lot of debt, it was also trying to figure out about possibly driving and maybe saving up some money for a car so that when I came back to school, I wouldn't have to deal with the same situation that I did in the previous years.
She's planning to return to Towson next fall. At this point, she says she'll likely take the bus to get there. Getting to Towson by public transit may take much longer than by car, but it's possible. There are many places and many job opportunities in the Baltimore area that you can't reach by public transit. So does mass transit erase the lines between people who can afford cars and people who can't? And how can we connect where the jobs are with where people live? Joining me now to talk about it is Adi Tomer, a senior research associate at the Brookings Institution in Washington. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And here with me in the studio is Michael Walk, acting director of service development for the Maryland Transit Administration, or MTA. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Adi, Brookings studied the connection between public transportation and how it affects job opportunities in the 100 largest metro areas in the United States. Briefly, what were your main findings?
Yeah, our overall finding was that transit in America, similar to Mike's agency all across the country, his peers, that is, do a really good job running either trains or buses to the places where people live and the kind of centralized areas where jobs tend to locate. So in that sense, we say transit does a really good job on its coverage. The problem becomes that, frankly, in America, we've been growing outwardly from a geographic sense, growing further and further from our job centers and classic downtowns. And this really complicates transit's ability to connect all the areas to one another. It really makes car ownership and car driving a more attractive option, certainly when it comes to time. And that puts transit in a tough position to connect all these disparate areas that might be quite far from one another and frankly may not have a huge customer base to connect specific locations to one another. It's a consistent pattern we found across the country, whether we're talking the largest metro areas like New York, a classic transit center, to some of the smallest ones like Modesto, California.
And how did Baltimore fare?
Baltimore actually did really well. It ranked 26th when it came to connecting jobs to kind of their potential labor base. So actually making sure that people could reach jobs across the metro area. So there's coverage there for the jobs themselves. But when really connecting them to one another, it kind of dropped off a little bit, which, again, I think speaks to Baltimore's connectivity difficulties in terms of how big the metro is geographically.
Well, let me try to home in on this. According to the report, in the Baltimore metro area, 98% of low-income neighborhoods had access to public transit, but only 30% of all jobs were reachable by public transit within 90 minutes. So, Adi, what does that tell us?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it tells us a couple things. Number one is that even though there's quite a few low-income households that live outside the core, that's still the biggest single concentration of them. And, of course, the MTA does a great job offering bus and rail service in and out of the downtown central area. So many of those, almost all of those households, as you indicated, 98%, live in neighborhoods that are served by transit. The problem comes in that so many of the job opportunities are spread all throughout the metro area, whether from Queen Anne's County to Howard County to Carroll. There's jobs all over the place, not just in your classic downtown Baltimore. And even if transit can get you there, sometimes, as the example you gave earlier in the segment, is the time may kind of run out on the opportunity, or someone may have to sit on a bus through transfers and other things well over 90 minutes. And that really complicates, again, people's ability to take transit when measured against the opportunities a car may present.
Michael Walk, you help MTA decide where to provide service, where to put bus routes, et cetera. And so in our region, neighborhoods with a lot of poor and unemployed people, areas with a lot of good jobs, not a lot of overlap, do you explicitly consider how to connect high poverty neighborhoods to areas where the jobs are?
That's an interesting question. I mean, a lot goes into deciding where a bus route will go and from what end to what end. One of the interesting components is a lot of it is based on the history. I mean, a lot of the bus routes that we have at the MTA are older than the MTA itself. So they were predicated on the way the demographics used to lay out in terms of the land use patterns and things from a long time ago. In fact, some even before the 1900s. So what we try to do now is, we are focusing on looking at the current network design and trying to, align it as best we can with where the population is concentrated. Although, as Adi pointed out, the job concentration is a little bit more sparse. So therefore, those considerations about how to actually connect, areas of, low-income housing, that kind of population concentration to where the jobs are, suddenly becomes a more complicated question for us.
Okay, I got to ask this before we go on, because I'm a sucker for history. I love history. But why does that make any difference about where the bus routes should be now?
Mostly the challenge when you're dealing with a network that's already designed is that it is currently being utilized. So there's the question of to make changes, of course, whether large or small, impacts the current customer base, current rider base. Our bus system carries over 240,000 people every day using it, over 72 million trips a year. So the network as designed carries a lot of people. So any changes we make at this point, we always have to very carefully balance that with the impact it has to the current ridership, unless you're going to just add additional resources, which would allow us to expand our coverage levels without having to cannibalize existing services.
Additional resources, meaning more money.
Sure, more money, more operators, more buses, yeah.
Well, Adi, where are the jobs in the Baltimore metro area? Your study looked at this. What did you find?
Yeah, sure. So in general, we find jobs to be essentially about half of them are more from at least 10 miles or further from the central business district. Now, that's actually one of the highest shares in the country. So even though a place like Baltimore, which has such a well-known kind of vista through its downtown, whether you live in Baltimore or not, so many people drive on I-95 through there, know about the two tunnels, seeing that view, seeing the stadiums, really feels like a big, dense downtown. And in many ways, it is. There's quite a few jobs there. There's housing, neighborhoods that are really coming up from a time when they were less valuable, at least in terms of property. But at the same time, there's still a tremendous amount of jobs, you know, as Michael alluded to as well, about that are not close and that oftentimes are spread quite thin. And many of those, and what we found in our research, not just through the numbers, but frankly talking to people on the ground, especially at agencies, both in housing and transportation across the country, is that so many of the jobs that low-income households might be most qualified for tend to not concentrate in those downtown areas. So we kind of found a weird combination of which Baltimore is really typical. You may have all of these great white-collar jobs downtown that transit does a really good job serving, especially from the places with interurban kind of classic routes, as Michael was just alluding to, for Baltimore. But oftentimes, they're the least likely to take transit. And the low-income households who are well-served may not be qualified for all those white-collar, high-skill jobs downtown. So what they need is access to low-density, lower-skill jobs on the periphery. And it's a really tough combination for transit agencies with limited resources to provide those kind of services in a more sprawling kind of development pattern, whether it be for the households themselves or the job centers where they could be qualified to work.
So, Michael Walk, what is the best option for a city resident who wants to take MTA to one of those jobs 10 miles outside the city?
Well, it really just depends on where that final destination is. I mean, as your interviews pointed out, there's certainly very, very many areas that are served by public transit on the periphery. But as in terms of the whole spread of those areas, there's a lot of gaps in between. So, you know, if you're a downtown resident trying to get out to the Baltimore suburbs by transit, obviously it's a lot more challenging unless you're aligning yourself along the rail network, the light rail or the subway, metro out towards Owings Mills and something. But if you're in between the gaps out on the outer edges of the city and then Baltimore County, certainly can be very challenging, if not inaccessible, by transit.
That's Michael Walk, Acting Director of Service Development for MTA, the Maryland Transit Administration, here on Maryland Morning, The Lines Between Us on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're also talking to Adi Tomer, Senior Research Associate at the Brookings Institution, about getting people to work via public transit. Amber Jones, the Towson student we heard from earlier, said she felt public transit in Baltimore is pretty good, but she says she sees one glaring problem.
I feel for anyone who has to go to work on a Sunday and take public transportation. It just takes forever. Sometimes the bus driver isn't on time. There are only about 2 buses per hour. And there are all types of factors that just make it very difficult.
Weekend shifts, night shifts, other off-normal hours, lots of low- and middle-skill jobs have shift work. So, Michael, what's the answer for them?
Once again, there's no simple answer, to that kind of a challenge. I mean, obviously, frequency on weekends and evenings and overnight, is much reduced. You know, the buses are more spaced out. They don't come as frequently. And certainly that creates a travel challenge for people that do need to get to shifts. And there is no simple answer, with the exception of whatever an agency can do to try to identify where it can improve those frequencies within its means. And I mean, the biggest challenge that Adi has been alluding to as well is as transit agencies are struggling with resource constraints, we try to focus as much as we can on where the service is needed based on, the demonstrated need or demonstrated ridership. We try to focus on that and meet the needs of our current customer base. Certainly not in a really good position at this point to try to expand that market, which is one of the challenges that we're up against. We try to find ways to meet new demands, new needs, better serve weekend riders, better serve evening riders. But all of those things are very costly. That is a balancing act that we have to sort of maintain over time.
Adi, I've been looking at this from a worker's perspective. I mean, I assume that during the recession, even when a lot of workers couldn't get to a job they might be qualified for, the employer could still find someone who could do the commute to do that job. But as the economy gets stronger, are employers going to have a hard time filling jobs in these outlying jobs if workers can't get to them?
Yeah, it's a it's a huge question that, frankly, metropolitan leaders, you know, not necessarily just the big city mayors, let's say, but also the leaders at the county level or in smaller municipalities are facing, is what's the future of their kind of job nodes, even if they're sparse and, you know, just a strip mall, let's say, versus a downtown office tower. You know, what's the prospects for the employers in those kind of places or a suburban office park? And the biggest thing we're seeing that confronts that is not only are we back to economic growth, which is great for everyone, but we're also seeing a generational shift. The quote-unquote millennials and also the Generation Xers. So these are people who are certainly below the age of 40 and many times below the age of even 30 are showing an enormous preference for non-automobile living, or certainly if they maybe own a car, they don't want to use it all week. They're looking for denser neighborhoods, not necessarily, again, you know, condominium towers, but just, you know, denser kind of row houses, of which, fortunately, places like Baltimore have great bones for. And again, the transit systems in general, including the MTA, are really best suited to kind of procure services in those areas. As those kind of workers come are coming online and looking for jobs, it's really a question of, are the employers willing to locate in places that are accessible for the best possible workers for them? It's something we're confronting. You mentioned Washington and Arlington. It's becoming incredibly attractive for employers to locate in those areas. The Boston Tech Corridor, which is outside of downtown Boston, many of those firms are looking to locate into downtown Boston because that gives them better access to the best labor pool. So it's a major question moving forward. The good thing is, from a transit perspective, is that it looks like neighborhoods will grow up, both in terms of job-rich neighborhoods as well as kind of household-rich neighborhoods, that will make the transit agency's jobs easier, provide them opportunities to have routes that are even more well-ridden, and kind of bring up the better problem of figuring out, can we procure enough service? Or let's say what DC is going through right now, which the transit system, Metrorail in particular, might reach capacity in the next 10 years. That's a better problem to have than finding empty buses and trains running throughout your system.
We are almost out of time. Adi, what solution would you like to see us focus on most?
Yeah, sure. I think that, again, you know, the transit agency, and it's not just because Michael's here in the room as well, but, you know, the transit agencies are doing everything they can. You know, what we need to do across the country, including Baltimore, is make sure, again, that the transit and transportation heads are at the same table with land use planners as well as economic development officials to ensure that we're making decisions that take into account not only the kind of generational demographic shifts we're seeing, but also what's in best interest of all the key players so we can build a metropolitan physical environment that best works for our economic future.
Michael, I'll give you the last word. What do you think we should be most focusing on to solve these problems?
I actually absolutely agree with what Adi is saying. I mean, the fact is that a transit agency is best suited to a geometry, a land use decisions that are dense in nature. That increases the efficiency. So if we want to have efficient and effective transit organizations, then, you know, we do need to be a better aligning those land use decisions with the transit network and the concept of dense growth. On the other side, if it's okay to have, you know, empty buses running around, you know, not be as efficient but provide that public service, you know, then, you know, transit could be reaching out and providing additional coverage to those areas. But it's at a cost. It's at a cost to the state and you know, it certainly makes the transit agency less efficient to do that. But that has to be okay with everybody.
We have to leave it there. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Adi Tomer is a senior research associate at the Brookings Institution. Michael Walk is acting director of service development for the MTA, the Maryland Transit Administration. We have a link to the Brookings report that Adi worked on, Missed Opportunity, Transit and Jobs in Metro America, at our website, wypr.org. Click on the Maryland Morning link. We've also got our own map of where the jobs are in the Baltimore area at our series website, linesbetweenus.org. Adi said that transportation agencies like the MTA are doing everything they can to provide good transit service. We'd like to know what you think. Leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. If you want to grab a pen, I'll give you that number again in a minute. You can also send us an email at mdmorning@wypr.org. And of course, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. The phone number again, if you want to leave us a voicemail, 410-881-3162. I'm Sheila Cass. This is Maryland Morning. Coming up on The Lines Between Us, building wealth from the ground up. Stay tuned to 88.1.
I'm assistant producer Jamila Kay. You're listening to Maryland Morning's The Lines Between Us series on WYPR 88.1 in Baltimore. Visit our website, linesbetweenus.org, to hear more stories, to see maps that reveal the lines in your neighborhood, and to participate in the discussion. Thanks for downloading this week's show. Now back to the podcast.
On 88.1, welcome back to The Lines Between Us. I'm Tom Hall. For a lot of people, getting a higher paying job and buying a home is the ticket for building wealth and assets. But people living from paycheck to paycheck who don't own their own home face obstacles that make building wealth over time difficult. Althea Saunders-Rainier joins me in the studio. She's the director of financial services at Our Money Place, a program of the Bon Secours Working Family Initiative. She works with people in various income brackets to help them increase their financial prospects. Althea Saunders-Rainier, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So tell us about Our Money Place, who you serve, and what you do.
Our Money Place was started in 2003. With help from the community, Operation Reach Out Southwest, which is the community coalition in Southwest Baltimore, as part of their economic development plan to bring back financial services to the community so that folks could begin to think about growing wealth and increasing their income.
In 2011, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, did a survey of unbanked and underbanked households, that is, folks that don't keep their money in a secured financial institution, or if they do, they use it in a limited way. So compared to other states, Maryland had a lower number of individuals who were unbanked. But those making less than $15,000 a year, and in particular African-American families, comprise the highest proportion of unbanked households. From your experience, why is that the case?
Well, there's still a lot of stigma around financial institutions, our mainstream financial institutions. And oftentimes, they don't come and stay in the low and moderate income neighborhoods because the ability to make money through loans is not always as profitable as it is in more affluent neighborhoods. And so they come with the idea that they want to service the community when in reality, unfortunately, many of them are just trying to cover a CRA requirement.
CRA meaning?
Community Reinvestment Act, wherein you need to go into an underserved neighborhood in order to really promote something else that you're about.
Mm-hmm. So you got it working on both sides. You've got the banks reluctant or doing it reluctantly, serving these communities. But you also have folks in the communities that have a sort of historical distrust of banks. I mean, for a lot of folks, banks have not been their friends over the years.
This is very true. And especially as we all know in the African-American community, there's still a considerable amount of distrust even as we move into this new century. So trying to get folks to understand the importance of being in part of mainstream banking is still a challenge we have, as well as the fact that financial education is very lacking in schools still. And so this makes it very difficult for us to impart this message in terms of how to really grow true wealth and what that really means and what that really looks like.
And of course, in a lot of these neighborhoods, there's an abundance of check cashing places, places that are sort of, fringe financial institutions. They're not banks. They don't provide the services that banks do. Are you finding that a lot of the folks that you're working with are still utilizing these check cashing places? And is that, I would imagine that's a pretty significant obstacle to building wealth over time.
It is a difficult obstacle to building wealth. Many use the check cashers because the check casher was also presumed to be the one who had the better customer service. The check casher would still be in the community. Many of these people do go to work every day, have bills that need to be paid, and they became friends with the check casher, and the check casher didn't leave. Oftentimes, the financial institution came, and after being there for a little while, they would leave the community.
One of your former colleagues told a story about an elderly or an older African-American woman talking about why she doesn't use a bank. And she said, in the 60s, they wouldn't let us into the bank. Then in the 70s, they said we should used the bank. And in the 80s, a lot of the banks went bust. And these are the same institutions that did predatory lending procedures and whatnot. Are you finding less resistance in the younger generation than in the older generation?
Certainly. The younger generation is less resistance. There's that middle-of-the-road generation, as I like to say, that was still hearing a lot of those stories and still resistant to them. And what I find is that we talk about check cashing as not being good, but when you're in these low to moderate income neighborhoods and when you're in a financial institution, if you do not use it on a continual basis, if you have unstable income, you are left with a balance in the bank that can generate throughout your financial history in that it can end up on your credit report. What we have found in the individuals we have worked with over time is that when they get stable employment, what they do come back and say to me, okay, now I want to know about that product that costs me less. Because now money is very important to them because they have consistent employment.
Yeah, and so it's that stability of the income that's the key factor there.
Yes.
Yeah. And if a person, you know, is employed, maybe making minimum wage or something above minimum wage, are there specific things that you're telling that person to do in terms of saving and trying to build up wealth? It's very difficult to do from that position.
If we can just get them to save a couple of dollars a week, just to begin the process of saving is very important. Pay yourself first, as we like to say.
What's the biggest challenge you face day to day when you're working with the clients that you serve?
Our biggest challenge is for individuals to have consistent employment and affordable housing.
Housing is it. Housing is such a key thing for everybody, isn't it?
It is. Because while we can put together all the financial education without stable employment and affordable housing, it is very difficult for families to take care of their families. There's always that struggle to survive. I am a financial coach, and so bringing awareness around individuals to help them understand where they are and how they will get to that place where they have financial self-sufficiency, where they can get market rate loans, where they can change jobs, where they can save money.
Can you share with us an anecdote about an individual person that you've worked with that's had some success in building some savings and some assets?
Oh, yes, I can. I have an individual. She has put together a debt management plan, and she has paid down nearly $3,000 to $4,000 in debt, and has continued that process with the goal of being ready for home ownership next year.
Well, it's really, really important work. Thank you for doing that work, and thank you for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Althea Saunders-Rainier is the Director of Financial Services at Our Money Place. It's a program of the Bon Secours Working Family Initiative. Now back to the subject of taxes. Many people receive refunds from their federal and state returns, which presents an opportunity for saving and getting on firmer financial ground. Sarah Johnson is the executive director of the Baltimore Cash Campaign. Cash stands for Creating Assets, Savings, and Hope. And she joins me in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So you all provide free tax preparation services for folks. You were on the show about a year ago. You talked to Sheila. And at that point, you were hoping to file about 9,000 returns in 2012. How did you do?
We did really well last year. We actually filed over 10,000 returns last year. It was a really great year for us. We had a huge amount of demand in the community. And, it's so exciting to hear the numbers. So we had about $18 million in federal and state refunds and an additional $6 million in the earned income tax credits coming back into our community last year by filing those returns.
That's great. So who's your clientele? How do you qualify to get a free tax prep from the Baltimore Cash Campaign?
So to qualify for free tax preparation, we do taxes for families of two or more who made $50,000 or less last year, or if you're a single filer and made $25,000 or less last year.
In 2012, the IRS estimates that the average refund was about $3,000, a lot of money. After individuals file, I mean, what do you try to steer them? What direction do you try to steer them in terms of what they can do with their refund?
Tax time is a great time to start talking to people about savings, right? It's in our name, Savings and Hope. We try and make sure people know that at tax time, they have the option to split their refund into multiple accounts. Outside of tax season, we're also doing financial coaching. So that's sort of like life coaching for your finances. Again, we train volunteers to be coaches and pair them with folks who might be interested in receiving some financial support. Anything from trying to make a financial decision. So we've had a person recently who said, I just need help deciding whether or not I can retire or not. So we had a coach paired with her. They had a couple of sessions to look through and see what was the income, what living expenses, and it really helped her like set some goals around when she could plan to retire. And then some people who are over their head in debt and need some help figuring out where to start. So that's our financial education and financial coaching program. But during tax time is the moment to really talk to people about these other financial education options. But it really starts with a little bit of savings at tax time.
Right. And of course, the financial advisor types always talk about asset building. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes those assets are built through equity in a home or maybe even a car, something like that, or savings accounts. But for folks who are renting, who don't own their own home, who maybe don't even own a car, taking public transportation. Some of them don't even have bank accounts. The common financial advice doesn't apply to them. So what advice do we give to folks who are, you know, virtually living from paycheck to paycheck, who may get this windfall around tax time?
I mean, I would say actually the advice that we give our clients, and, you know, I use the word advice, loosely here. I mean, we're not financial advisors. I want to be very clear about that. But the tips are sort of common best practices that we're sharing with our tax clients is when you have this moment to do a little bit of savings at tax time, do it. You know, putting a little bit away, I mean, that's the same advice you give to anyone of any means, right, is to always create an emergency savings fund or saving for your child's future. And so tax time is a perfect time to be able to split that refund. We find a lot of people like to buy U.S. savings bonds. You can buy them in small increments of $50 and up, and you can buy them for your child or for a godchild. And we find that most of our clients are buying them. We actually just sold 5 of them yesterday, and our tax sites just opened. So, you know, we know that people are doing this at tax time when they have the opportunity to save.
What are some of the financial goals that your clients come in to you with?
Well, we find that most of our clients at tax time, when we survey our clients, they have debt that they're trying to pay off, a lot of issues around utility bills and back rent. So a lot of people are using their refunds to get caught up. A lot of folks have the same goals that anyone would have in terms of wanting to save for a house, wanting to save for a car, saving for education. Those are probably some of the big goals that we see people wanting to achieve. And what we try and work with them is, you know, there's the math side of financial education and financial wellness, and there's also the sort of the emotional or psychosocial side. And so we try and blend the two in the work that we do of helping meet people where they are and figuring out where they need to start in terms of reaching those long-term goals is often with just getting your house in order.
Is there an issue, a challenge that you face in your work about people not filing who could file and get a refund? I mean, there's the earned income tax credit, which has been much in the news lately because, you know, the Congress has been talking about what to do with it, what the future of it is, but it exists now. Are there people filing that are not taking advantage of money that they could be getting?
Certainly. I mean, we know that there's a huge economic multiplier effect with the earned income tax credit. For every $1 that goes into the economy of spending, it's $1.5 back in the community really generating. And so when you think about the fact that we have about $14 million in Baltimore City of unclaimed earned income tax credit, and that's a very conservative estimate. So we just know that there are people who are out there who aren't filing. Our capacity is growing all the time with our community partners, but we'd love to have more help to really be able to serve more people and get more of this earned income tax credit into families' pockets and into our community.
Sarah Johnson is the executive director of the Baltimore Cash Campaign. Cash is creating assets, savings, and hope. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We've got more information about Baltimore Cash Campaign and Our Money Place on our website, WYPR.org. You've been listening to our series, The Lines Between Us, which we share with you every Friday here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. On Monday morning, theater critic J. Wynn Russick and I will talk about Beauty and the Beast at the Hippodrome Theater, and the artist Raoul Middleman will walk me through his new show at the C. Grimaldis Gallery. That's all coming up Monday morning on Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus, or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at wypr.org. Have a great day.